I would like to devote the first part of the shiur this evening to discuss a feature of the Tfilis of Rosh Hashanah. As we know, of course, Rosh Hashanah has many distinct mitzvahs and minhagim, but also in the heartland of the Rosh Hashanah davening, there's something which is quite distinctive, namely the Musaf. As we know, every Shabbos, every Yom Tov, the first three brachas and the final three brachas will always be the same. And in the middle, there'll be one bracha, which is referred to as Kedushas Hayom. It ends Mekadesh HaShabbos, Mekadesh Yisrael Vahazmanim. That is true for Shabbos, it's true for Yom Tov, it's true for Yom Kippur. As we know, however, Rosh Hashanah is unique in this respect, whereby the Musaf has three middle brachas, giving us a total of nine brachas, the first three, the middle three, and the final three. Interestingly, the Gemara in Maseches Brachas, in the fourth perek, finds an allusion to this total of nine brachas of Musaf in the nine references to Hashem's name in Tfilas Chana, Chana's prayer, which was offered on Rosh Hashanah, which is the Haftarah for the first day of Rosh Hashanah. Day one of Rosh Hashanah is Chus Imahos. Day two is Chus Avos. That's why on the first day we read Vashem Pakad Asara. On the second day we read about the Akedah. Therefore, the appropriate Haftarah to parallel Sarah's experience is that of Chana. And Chana refers to Hashem's name nine times. And there's a whole literature really on Tfilas Chana. And one of the fallouts from that, the reverberations, are the nine brachas of the Musaf prayer. Interestingly, as much as we mentioned that there is every Yom Tov has its Kedushas Hayom, and the three middle brachas of Rosh Hashanah, Malchios, Zichronos, and Shofaros. So whatever happened to Kedushas Hayom? It also deserves to be there. It is there. It gets eclipsed almost by Malchios. But actually, the first of the middle three brachas, Malchios, is also twinned together and combines Kedushas Hayom. And that's why we conclude with the way that we would conclude the middle bracha of every Rosh Hashanah davening. Melech HaKol HaAretz, Mekadesh Yisrael, V'yom HaZikaron. That's Kedushas Hayom. Interestingly, and it's a subtle point, but if we keep an eye on the flow of Malchios, Zichronos, and Shofaros, this will explain to us one very interesting point. And that is, as we will discuss in Mitz Hashem soon, you have your psukim, really the heart of the brachas are the ten psukim. Three from Torah, three from Nevi'im, three from Ksuvim, and then the final one is from Torah again. The Torah gets the final word. It's the first and last. Interestingly, pasuk from the Torah, where does it feature within the bracha? If you watch carefully, you'll note that Malchios in this respect differs from Zichronos and Shofaros. How so? In Zichronos and Shofaros, the final pasuk is actually woven into the concluding paragraph. As we know, the structure of these middle brachas, they have an introduction, they have the psukim, and then they have a concluding paragraph. The introduction, Malchios begins with Aleinu. Actually, the origins of Aleinu is from Malchios. Originally, it was only said on Rosh Hashanah. That's where it comes from. Later on, it was added as the conclusion of really all of our tefillahs. That's somewhat later on. But the origins of Aleinu, in terms of a fixture within the tefillah, are in the Musaf of Rosh Hashanah. I remember it was just two or three years ago, one of my younger sons, he came with me to davening. It was his first full Rosh Hashanah davening. And he was told that it would be a long time. And much to his surprise, he'd barely gotten into Shemona Esrei, and it was already Aleinu. And he turned to me in the middle of his Amida, like, this is Aleinu? This is it? He found out that that was not it. So that begins with Aleinu, and Zichronos has its opening, Ata Zocher, Shofaros has its opening, Ata Niglesa, and they also have concluding paragraphs. The final pasuk from the Torah in Zichronos is part of the concluding paragraph. The final pasuk of Shofaros is part of the concluding paragraph. But the final pasuk of Malchios is not part of the concluding paragraph. The final pasuk of Malchios is simply added on to the other psukim. We mention the other psukim, and we say, "Ubisarosha kasuv leimor Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad." It's not woven into the fabric of the concluding paragraph. And the reason why, says the Abu Dharam, is because the concluding paragraph of Malchios is not like the concluding paragraph of Zichronos and Shofaros. Their paragraphs, the whole bracha, is only Zichronos. It's only Shofaros. And therefore, the pasuk of Zichronos and Shofaros finds its place as you get towards the conclusion of that bracha. But as we mentioned, the bracha of Malchios is not only Malchios. It doubles, so to speak, as well as Kedushas Hayom. And therefore, we hold off from confirming it in that very exclusive way to Malchios. We leave it open, that concluding paragraph, so that it can cap Malchios, but also Kedushas Hayom. That's why the final pasuk of Malchios actually happens before the concluding paragraph. These are matters of great interest for those who wish to pay close attention to the brachas and to compare them with each other. Now, where does Malchios, Zichronos, and Shofaros come from? Actually, if we look at the Gemara, in two places, they appear to come from the Torah itself. The Gemara in Maseches Rosh Hashanah, not surprisingly, on Daf Lamed Beis, darshans the psukim that relate to Rosh Hashanah. What is the pasuk of Rosh Hashanah? Zichron Trua, Mikra Kodesh. And the Gemara says each these terms, Zichron is Zichronos, Trua is Shofaros, and what about Malchios? That's the words Ani Hashem Elokeichem, which lead into the Rosh Hashanah in Parshas Pinchas Uvachodesh Hashvi. It begins in Emor Ani Hashem Elokeichem. So Ani Hashem Elokeichem is Malchios, Zichron is Zichronos, and Trua is Shofaros, and that, at face value, sounds like these brachos are de'oraisa requirements, Torah requirements to talk about on some level on Rosh Hashanah. And interestingly, that is also the way Rashi explains the words Zichron Trua. In his Perush on the Torah, aside from his Perush on the Gemara, in Parshas Emor, in Vayikra Perek Pasuk Kaf Dalet, B'chodesh Hashvi be'echad l'chodesh, the seventh month, Tishrei be'echad l'chodesh, Rosh Hashanah, Yelechem Shabbason, shall be a day of rest. Zichron Trua, says Rashi, Zikaron Psuke Zichronos, Psuke Shofaros, Liskor Lachem Akedas Yitzchak. So Rashi explains as well, Zichron Trua are remembering through Psukim Zichronos and Shofaros. Rashi here doesn't mention Malchios, the Gemara brought that in from the words nearby. But once again, the Gemara draws it from the Psukim. Rashi explains the Psukim, and it really sounds like Malchios, Zichronos, and Shofaros are a deraisa requirement alongside the mitzvah of Shofar itself. And additionally, the Gemara in the first parak of Rosh Hashanah, Daf Tet Zayin, says as follows. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, says Hashem. It's a well-known two lines of the Gemara, Ve'imru lefanai b'Rosh Hashanah, say before me on Rosh Hashanah, Malchios, Zichronos, and Shofaros. Why? As the Gemara explains, Malchios, why Malchios? Kedei she'tam lichuni aleichem, says Hashem, so that you accept me upon yourselves as king. Zichronos, why Zichronos? Kedei she'yale zichronchem lefanai letova, so that your remembrance comes before me for good. Uvama. And what is the tool? With what does all this happen? Bashofar. So once again, certainly in terms of Malchios and Zichronos, they are introduced with the words Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Imru Lefonai. Hashem says, say before me. That sounds like that's Doraisa. When Hashem is talking, that's Doraisa. That's the Torah talking. However, there is a seeming clashing statement in the Gemara at the very end of Rosh Hashanah. The Gemara discusses a case of a person who, he's in between two cities, he's in the village, he doesn't have anything there, he's nowhere, he doesn't have Nocha Shofar, he doesn't have Malchus Zichronos and Shofar, he doesn't have a Machzor. But he does know that tomorrow, in the town or in the city to the one side of him, They've got a chauffeur there. And then the city to the other side of him, they're going to be saying Malchus, Echonus, and Shofaros. Only one each. The town that has a chauffeur doesn't have a Machzor. And the town that has a Machzor doesn't have a chauffeur. This is the original tale of two cities. And he has to know what to decide. And the Gemara states unequivocally, you've got to go where the chauffeur is. You don't go where the Machzor is. And moreover, the Gemara is actually even astonished that this needed to be said. Obviously, says the Gemara, the chauffeur is Daraisa. These brachos, Malchus, Echonus, and Shofaros, that's Darabanan, obviously. Until the Gemara fine-tunes and says, no, the chiddush is, the chap is, even if you're not sure whether there'll be a chauffeur in the one town, you have reliable information that there might be, but you're not sure, and there definitely will be Malchus, Echonus, and Shofaros going on, you still go for the possible Daraisa, not for the definite Darabanan. Fine, we found our chiddush. But the point is, we do see very clearly, the Gemara has stated black on white, that whereas shofar is Daraisa, these brachas are Darabanan. What then are we to make of those drashos? What then are we to make of the Gemara which says, Hashem says to say Malchus, Echonus, and Shofaros, which seem to imply that it was Daraisa? Well, this question is the basis or the background to a famous discussion in the parish of the Ritva, Rabbeinu Yontov from Seville, to Rosh Hashanah there, and the Ritva explains, there is a concept called asmachta, an attachment. And what asmachta means, there's actually more than one type of asmachta, but in this respect, asmachta means it is a rabbinic law, but it's somehow based on a pasuk. And they'll quote you, so to speak. But of course, the question is, well, that seems to be a contradiction in terms. If a pasuk is the source, so that's daraisa. But if it's drabanan, then there is no source. So how can it be drabanan and have a source in the Torah? But the Ritva says the Torah, if we paraphrase his words, the Torah communicates on different levels. There are some things that the Torah instructs or commands, and those are, that's daraisa. A mitzvah is a Torah command. But there are other ideas. There are other things where the Torah does not command, but it makes very clear what it wants. And that's an interesting situation, because in the Ritva's words, Hashem did not command it, but he's given a marker. And when the time comes and the rabbis feel that it's correct to do so, that becomes their impetus. That becomes their inspiration. And ultimately, the basis for their takana. And therefore, although it's not the arisa because the Torah didn't command it, it ultimately is the source for this Darabanan din. It's a very interesting domain called asmachta. And therefore, says Ritva, if you look at Zichron and Trua, I mean, look at it, and what does it seem like it's saying? And even if the Torah doesn't say psukim, Zichron and Trua, and put it all together, the Gemara is, and it's Rabbi Akiva's words actually, Rabbi Akiva is quite comfortable saying, Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem, this, because this is what Hashem is saying. It's not what Hashem's commanding, but it's what Hashem is saying. And if one could say, part of the job of the Rabbanan is to give us not only an elucidation of what Hashem is commanding, but also to pick up for us what Hashem is saying. So that's Malchus, Echonus, and Shofaros are one of those things. And if there's ever a time where we wish to be sensitive to what Hashem is saying and not what he's commanding, it's going to be Rosh Hashanah. And that's how the Ritva resolves the question. Again, there are seeming drushes, but the Gemara says it's Darabanan. How can it be both? It's an asmachta. That is the classic response of Ritva. I have to say, over the course of the last 24 hours, I came across a separate response from three different places, but all of them much more recent. I first saw it in the writings of Rav Osher Weiss, Shlita. I subsequently saw it in the writings of Rav Soloveitchik, and then further saw it in the writings of Rav Sternbuch, whose first sefer came out about getting on for 50 years now. His first volume of Moedim Uzmanim, published in 1969. And Rav Sternbuch states, again, just it's worthwhile mentioning because it cuts through everything, even though in the end Rav Sternbuch says, that's my opinion, but I retract if the Ritva said differently. Our problem is that the Torah says, the Gemara says, there's psukim to give you these brachos, Malchus, Echonus, and Shofaros. But elsewhere, the Gemara says that they're drabanan. How can the two live together? Says Rav Sternberg, it could be that these are de'oraisa, these brachas, but only when they accompany the shofar. Because zichra and truah means you mention all these things together with the truah. So if you have a shofar, they really are from the Torah. The Gemara that says that the Rabbanon is because the Gemara was discussing a situation specifically where the one town that has the shofar doesn't have the machzor. And therefore, in the absence of the shofar, they're for sure Rabbanon. But it could be in the presence of the shofar, they are absolutely d'oraisa. It's really a fascinating idea. But once again, Rav Sternbuch, he takes us to the brink, but says, but the Ritva said otherwise. I'm just mentioning my thoughts, says Rav Sternbuch. Now, in terms of the psukim, how are they? What's the makeup there? Well, the Mishnah tells us actually, and that's the halacha, that we have 10 psukim, and the Gemara discusses the significance of the number 10. Not hard to fathom, and there are a number of opinions among them. For example, corresponding to the Asara Ma'amaros, Shebahem Nivra Ha'olam, breakdown of the psukim. Well, the Gemara tells us you begin with 3 from Torah, then 3 from Ksuvim, then 3 from Nevi'im, and as we said, the final one comes from the Torah. Now, this is actually something which is, of course, of great interest to Rishonim already, because, once again, the order is first Torah, then Ksuvim, and then Nevi'im, and then Torah. Of course, as Tosfos themselves point out, that's not the order that we customarily mention these three in. We're familiar with Tanakh, Torah, Nevi'im, Ksuvim, for the various reasons. One could almost say it is a descending gradation of Kedusha, of potency. At the top, of course, first and foremost is the Torah, but then the Nevi'im, and then followed by Ksuvim. And that would seem to be, therefore, the norm. Why then, in these brachas, do we first begin with Ksuvim and then move on to Nevi'im? It should be noted, just parenthetically, but for the sake of broader disclosure, there are certain sources in Chazal, there's a Tosefta, which seems actually to indicate that it is Torah, then Nevi'im, and Ksuvim, but certainly the widespread minhag is first Torah, Ksuvim, and Nevi'im. Why do we break with the traditional order? Well, Tosas give a very interesting answer, and that is, actually, Torah, Ksuvim, and Nevi'im is in order. It's just not in our normal order, but it's actually in chronological order. Now, why do we say that? Because it happens to be that all of the psukim, as much as we talk about Ksuvim, all of the psukim from Ksuvim, as far as I know, in Rosh Hashanah Davening, Musaf, in Malchus, Aronus, and Shepharis, they're all from Sefer Tehillim. If you look, you'll see. It's all from Sefer Tehillim. Well, Sefer Tehillim is written by David HaMelech. David HaMelech lived before all of the Nevi'im whose words we quote. I mean, the quotations from the Nevi'im will come from Yeshaya and Yirmiyah and Yechezkel. But David HaMelech preceded them, historically. And therefore, says the Tosfos, that's the order that's being followed here, in the order in which they were said. First, the psukim of Torah were said, but then the psukim of Ksuvim, the ones that we are quoting, they're all from Tehillim, said by David HaMelech. And then finally, later on, or subsequently, the psukim of Nevi'im. Interesting. A fascinating parallel explanation comes from one of the later Mefarshim. It's a sefer called Korban Nesanel, written by Rav Nesanel Weil, the famous Weil family, and their forebears are great. Great Mefarshim. these are from Ashkenaz. The Korban Nesanel is a commentary on the Rosh. And Korban Nesanel says somewhat differently. And he suggests that actually the reason why we have them in this order is because it's the chronological order, not when they were said, but what are they referring to? You see, of course, we begin with Torah because the Torah is our first exposure to all of these concepts of Malchios, of Zichronos, and Shofaros. And that's our first encounters with these things. If you look at then the Psukim of Ksuvim and then of Nevi'im, which is fascinating to do, you'll see that the Psukim of Ksuvim, they tend to be things that are true on an ongoing basis. We talk about V'yavo Melech HaKavod, Mize Melech HaKavod. I mean, that's true on an ongoing basis. Hashem Malach, Eos Lavesh, Zecher asal nifla osav, and so on and so forth. Vachatzotzot tzokol shofar. So that's, they're almost like in the interim. They're true at any given time. So we go from the past to an ongoing basis. It's actually the psukim of Nevi'im that are specifically about the future, each one in their own way. Malchios, Bahaya Hashem lemelech hakol, Bayom hahu, on that day, hasn't happened yet. We haven't reached it yet. It will be. V'vayisal Hashem emlucha, v'alum moshim b'har tzion, as we know. That's an, and also the psukim of Zichronos, where Hashem in the future will remember and then bring the geula. And of course, Shofaros is takav shofar gadol l'chayroseinu, Bayom hahu, itakav shofar gadol. And therefore, says the Korban Nisano, in terms of content, in terms of topic, the flow is where these things were first introduced, how they are expressed on an ongoing basis, and how they will ultimately be expressed. That's the past, present, and future. Another very interesting comment, it's almost really in the parshanut between the psukim, because these are things that we will hear frequently. We introduce psukim from Torah, kakasu basarasa. We introduce psukim from Ksuvim and from Nevi'im. How do we introduce the psukim from Ksuvim? We say, uvetivrei kachecha kasuv lemor, in your holy writings, kasuv lemor. How do we introduce the words of the Nevi'im? We say, va'ayidei avadecha hanvi'im kasuv lemor. And again, the Avudrah asks a very interesting question. We would say, if we're quoting psukim, one pasuk is written in Ksuvim, another pasuk is written in the Nevi'im. And the, right, where's it from? That's from Ksuvim, that's from Nevi'im. And therefore, Avraham asked, why is it that when we quote psukim from Ksuvim, we say, uvedivrei kachecha kasuv lemor, it's written in the holy writings. So when it comes to Nevi'im, we should say, uvedivrei nevi'echa kasuv lemor. I mean, that parallels. This one's in Ksuvim, this one's in Nevi'im. Why is it that we have a somewhat more elongated introduction of the psukim of Nevi'im, whereby we say, "Va'ayidei avadecha hanavi'im kasuv lemor"? That's an interesting shaila. And the Avudram says, it's fascinating because it goes beyond Musaf of Rosh Hashanah. It's really about Nevi'im and Ksuvim. And it's a question that many have asked. What is the difference between Nevi'im and Ksuvim? It's not so simple. We understand the difference between Torah and the others, right? Torah is Hashem's word to Moshe, but Nevi'im and Ksuvim is more through Nevuah, or we could call Ruach HaKodesh. At the end of the day, it's hard to know what the difference between them is. But the Avudram says the difference is, and I subsequently saw this in the Pachad Yitzchak, makes the same distinction. I think he arrived at it by himself, but it's the roots are in the Avudram. He was preceded by the Avudram here. The difference between Nevi'im and Ksuvim is that the words of the Nevi'im, as much as they're written in a Sefer, their original transmission did not take the form of being written in a Sefer. Rather, the original transmission, as soon as you hear it, you hear it. The original transmission of Nevi'im was by the Navi, to the people. Verbally, orally, not scripturally. And in fact, the word Navi itself, as Rashi tells us in Parshas Va'era, comes from the word Nivsvasayim, which is to speak. Nevuah is always spoken. Subsequent to being spoken, it was then written down in the Nevi'im. Not so with Ksuvim. There was no instruction for any of the Ksuvim to be said. They went straight to written form. David HaMelech wrote to Tehillim. No one told him. Hashem did not tell him, go and say Tehillim to people. He doesn't have to. Not Shir HaShirim, not Kasuv HaHeles, not any of the above. It went straight to written form. And therefore, as much as Nevi'im, this is what divides Nevi'im and Ksuvim. As much as for us, we didn't hear the Nevi'im. So our first encounter with both of them is through a Sefer. But each one had its own journey till it got to a Sefer. Well, for the Ksuvim, it was direct, and for where it was spoken to the people. And that is why, says Avudraham, that difference, that very difference, is reflected in the way these psukim are introduced. When it comes to Ksuvim, we say, it's written in the Pasuk, and that's all there is to it. That's exactly what it is. It's meant to be written. Whereas with regards to Nevi'im, we don't say, because the truth is that originally it was said, the Al Yidei Avadecha Nevi'im, through their speaking, it then came to be written. So that's, again, it's a subtle distinction between these introductions, but it actually touches upon the basic difference between Nevi'im and Ksuvim. That's for our travels, we ended up learning from the Nusach of the Musaf of Rosh Hashanah. Well, I'd like to take a look at just a selection, one extract from a Pasuk of Malchias and one from Zichronus. In a sense, the Pasuk of Malchias, which may draw our attention here, is the final Pasuk. It's the Pasuk of from the Torah, Ubisarasla Kosev Limor, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. And the reason why we need to discuss it is because it's very easy to read it and not think about the fact that it doesn't formally talk about Malchias. As if to say, the other psukim are expressly discuss the idea of Malchias. Truas melech bo, vayihi bishurun melech, right? It's very, very clear. And then in the end, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, there is no doubting the central importance of the pasuk of Shema. That's not the discussion here. But it doesn't seem to relate directly to Malchias. However, I believe the explanation is based on the words of the Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato, in his Peirush, his Sefer, pardon me, Derech Hashem, which one could almost describe as the Shulchan Aruch of Jewish thought. And he discusses all of these things, and he talks about the Pasuk of Shema. Specifically, what do we mean when we say Hashem Echad? Because one can mean so many things. But what does it mean within the context of Shema? And he actually explains it on a number of levels. But one of the level that we wish to refer to is that when we say Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, he is one in the sense that, in addition to being the one and only, he's one in the sense that he unifies everything. Hashem Echad in the sense that he is the one controlling force in the world. Not only is he the one creator of the world, the one controlling force in the world. And what that means is that as much as, says Ramchal, if you look at the world, there's just so many different things going on in so many different directions, and it's possible to see 1,000 plans. And they're at odds with each other, or perhaps in tandem with each other, or perhaps parallel, or perhaps heading in the opposite direction. And if you thought the world was complicated in the 1700s, it hasn't gotten simpler in our time. The world is a complicated place. And what we say twice a day, and it's a very profound understanding of these words, Hashem Echad means whatever people do, and each one has their decisions, and of course will be accountable for them, but all of that is micro, but in the grand historical and global plan, there's Hashem Echad, that one force who will ensure that everything ends up the way that it should. That's what Hashem Echad means on that level, says Ramchal. And when you think about it, that is exactly what Malchius is. Malchius, that is, as if to say, it's not just a title. When we speak about Malchius, the Melech guides the kingdom. The Melech supervises the kingdom and arranges what needs to be arranged, intervenes when necessary, and keeps an eye on the bigger picture. And looked at in this way, with this Peirush of the Ramchal, I think we can well understand why the final pasuk, I would say the crowning pasuk of Malchios, is that pasuk of Shema Yisrael, meaning of Hashem Echad, is exactly what Malchios is. So it's very interesting because through raising the question, how has Echad got to do with Malchios, we deepen our understanding really of what Malchios means. And that's with regards to that final pasuk. When it comes to Zichronos, so I came across a very interesting question raised by Rav Soloveitchik. There's a collection of his teachings, his Chidushim actually, in a sefer called Harari Kedem. And again, the attention to detail, we could say Musaf of Rosh Hashanah for many years, and Mitzvah Hashem we will, without noticing these differences. But the psukim from the Navi in Zichronos. What are they? So, it says as follows, V'ayidei avadecha ha-Nevi'im kasuv le'mor, that's the introduction for Nevi'im, So these are well-known psukim for us, certainly the first and the last. Haloch v'karasa ba'aznei Yerushalayim ne'mor, Karma Hashem, Zachati l'chesed n'rayach, Avas k'lulosayach. Hashem remembers, Hashem says to Bnei Yisrael, I remember you. Your early kindness. Lechtechachar b'midbar be'eretz lo zuor. That famous statement, that amazing gesture, really, that leap of faith on the part of Bnei Yisrael, it's considered an outstanding merit from a certain point of view, even though there was a lot of teething problems, but it was really one of our greatest times. And when times get turbulent, or perhaps when we fall below par, Hashem said, but I haven't forgotten those early days. Okay, that's the pasuk from the Navi Yirmiyahu. Next, v'ne'emar, v'zocharti ani es brisi osach, b'imein urayach, again, I remember the covenant I made with you when you were yet young, v'akimosi lach bris olam, and there'll be an everlasting covenant. Good. That quotation is from the Navi Yechezkel. Okay. B'ne'emar, final, third of the three psukim from Navi, B'ne'emar, ha'ben yakir li Ephraim. In the Yelet Shashurim, Hashem said, what is he? Is he this precious child? He's such a delightful child. He is. But it starts out rhetorical, and then the very mention makes it actual. Because he is. Kimi bide dabribo, zechos kodot. So Hashem says, you know, I just have to talk about him, and I'm already falling to pieces. I'll move my ilo, I'll have rachmanis on him. That pasuk is from the Navi Yirmiyahu. It's actually the conclusion of the Haftarah for the second day of Rosh Hashanah. And therefore, we're in an interesting situation because, again, we talk about chronology. You've got two psukim from Yirmiyahu, one from Yechezkel, but we break. The first quotation, Zachati l'chesed n'rayach, Yirmiyahu. Then we move to Yechezkel, and then we move back to Yirmiyahu. Why do we do that? That's Rav Soloveitchik's question. And his answer is really wonderful. Says Rav Soloveitchik, and it's a very esoteric idea, the concept of Zichronos, ultimately, in the sense Hashem remembers. What it means is the connection that he has with the Jewish people. As we would recall, we'd feel connected. That's the sense of connection that Hashem has with the Jewish people. And says Rav Soloveitchik, there's two ways you can remember. When they were originally, the early times were good, and then the later times became rougher. There's two ways you can remember the early times. And he even says one could characterize them as a way that a father remembers and a way that a mother remembers. How does a father remember his young child? He doesn't forget, but you know, the child has grown up already, and as the child grows up, the way the father, this is of course a generalization, but it's generally true, the way the father relates to him, imagil, as he grows, I haven't forgotten, but you know, you're not a child anymore, etc. But from a certain point of view, says the Soloveitchik, in a mother's eyes, the child is always a child. And even though he's grown up, she still relates to him very often as a child. He could be the manager of a multinational company. She'll still be checking that he has enough food, and that his top button is buttoned up, and it's cold outside, and has he packed everything, and as if he's like 10 years old. It doesn't change. And therefore, we see that, in a sense, those early times, which are, you know, those pristine times, those idyllic times, the father remembers them, but times have changed. For the mother, nothing's changed. And of course, that, in terms of connection to those times, it's an ever-present connection. It's not even remembering the past, virtually. And says Rav Soloveitchik, that's why we begin with the pasuk in Yirmiyahu, which says, Hashem says, Zachati l'chesedah, I remember. Things have changed, but I haven't forgotten, so to speak. Zachati l'ch. And then we move to the pasuk in Yechezkel, because we haven't finished with that type of remembering. It's still, again, as the pasuk says, V'zachati ani es brisi osach. I remember the bris. B'meinu urayif. I remember. And there'll be a new bris, and it hasn't been forgotten. But then once we've represented or quoted from Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel about the first type of remembering, we then go to the second type of remembering. The second type of remembering, go back to Yirmiyahu. We had to break. It's a new type of remembering. What's a new type of remembering? Yisrael is still young. Haven Yakili Ephraim. Ephraim is the youngest. Im Yeled Shashuim. What, he's this delightful child? He is. Well, he's all grown up. He's not grown up. He may have grown up. But it's that way of remembering where you're back there, where everything was fine. And that, and from there comes the restoration. And from there comes the all the positive rectification. So this is, again, very beautiful in the nusach of the tefillah and the order of the psukim, things that perhaps we might not have noted ourselves or perhaps known what to do with or how to respond to. These are some comments. Pardon me? Right. Absolutely. So I'd like to conclude this section of introductory section of Malchus Zechronus and Shofaros by going back to the Gemara in Daf Tet Zayin, which we quoted before. And the Gemara states again, Imr Lefanai Malchus. It's a well-known statement, but we can gloss by it a little bit. Imr Lefanai Malchus. Why Malchus? Kidei Shetamlichuni Aleichem. In order that you crown me as your king. Zechronos, kidei shiyal zechonachan mefan letova. That your remembrance should come before me. Uvama, with shofar, and that gives us the shofaros. And there is perhaps a possibility that we look at these psukim, and it almost has like an automatic result. In other words, if you say these psukim, this will happen. If you say Malchus, if you say Zechronos, Yad Zechronachan Mefan Letova, and that is a dangerous perhaps a way to understand, because it sounds like it's just all you have to do is say the psukim. It sounds like almost like an incantation, and this is what will happen. But that's it. It's just the words, and that is why some Mefarshim say that the most important word in this formula is not Malchios or Zechronos, or Shofaros. It's the word before me. Imru lefanai, Malchus, Zechronos, and Shofaros. And perhaps to get more of an orientation as to what is the meaning of this word, lefanai, before me, this is the point where we now consult this statement in context, where we keep a statement in context. This statement about Malchus, Zechronos, and Shofaros, it is the fourth in a series of four statements that Rabbi Akiva made. And they're all about doing things lefanai. Briefly, the Gemara says, it goes through the kavanos of the Chagim. Amar Rabbi Akiva, Mipnei ma'ar matura haviu omer bepesach. We start with Pesach. Why does the Torah say to bring an omer? Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, haviu lefanai omer bepesach, bring an omer before me on Pesach, kidei shetisbarach lechem tevuah shebasados, so that the produce in the field will be blessed. Okay. Next, number two. Umipnei ma'amra Torah, haviu shtei halechem ba'atzeres, right from Pesach to Shavuos. Why does the Torah say shtei halechem? Because that's the time of Peres Ha'ilan. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, haviu lefanai shtei alechem ba'atzeres, bring the shtei alechem on Shavuos, kedesh yisparchu lachem, Peres Ha'ilan. Okay, the connection between the wheat of the shtei alechem and Peres Ha'ilan is discussed by the Mefarshim, but that's what it's about. And what comes next? Sukkos. Umifnei ma'or matorah nischu mayim b'chag. Why does the Torah say nischu hamayim, the well-known water which is brought as a korban there? Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Nisru lefanai mayim b'chag, kedei sheyisparchu b'chag yishmei shana. Because it's a time of rain, right? The rainy season begins on Sukkos, and therefore that's a time to bring a korban of water, the tabracha of rain. And then number four, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, v'emu lefanai, b'rosh Hashanah, malchus Zechronos and Shofaros. In other words, what we gain from seeing this well-known statement of malchus Zechronos and Shofaros in context is that it is the fourth of a series of four, all of which are referred to as lefanai. But actually the lefanai before me of the first three are easier to understand than the fourth. Because the first three, what do we mean when we say lefanai, before me, before Hashem? Where do we bring the Korban Omer? Before him, in the Beis HaMikdash. Where do we bring the Shtei Alechem? Before him, in the Beis HaMikdash. Where do we bring Nisuch HaMayim? Before him, in the Beis HaMikdash. So those three so far, lefanai is a geographical location. But then the final one says, Imur Lefanai, Malchus Echonus and Shofaros, which happens on Rosh Hashanah throughout the world, and not exclusively or restricted to the Beis HaMikdash, what then is the connotation of the word Lefanai, if it doesn't have to be before Hashem in the geographical sense? But the answer is, as much as Lefanai, before me, does not refer to the Beis HaMikdash geographically, it still has the same connotation as Lefanai for the first three, because Lefanai means you're before Hashem. It may not be geographically meant, but it is conceptually, that's what the word Lefanai means. As if to say, the first three happen in the Beis HaMikdash, number fourth has to happen under Beis HaMikdash conditions. And what does that mean? It means with focus, with devotion, with sincerity, with concentration, with genuineness. All these, that's Lefanai. As the list of four goes, it's the most amazing Lefanai, because you could be anywhere. But that demands a certain frame of mind. And this, I think, is probably the most important thing to know about Malchus Echonus and Shofaros. Because the desired effect, it doesn't come from Imru, it comes from Imru Lefanai. Possible to say the words, and before you look around, the paragraph is finished. That's called Imru, but it's not called Lefanai. As we're looking, so much has been put into these sections of Malchus Echonus and Shofaros. They contain within them the Yesodos of Judaism. Rabbi Yosef Albo in his Sefer Ikrim famously bases his Ikrim on the brachos of Malchus Echonus and Shofaros. Hashem's rulership, Schar Onesh, Matan Torah, and all of these things, and therefore, not to forget, as much as there's quite a lot to say, but it's not enough to say it. For the results to come through, the assurance comes, if what we put in is Lefanai, what comes out is what the Gemara says will come out. I'd like to move from here to discuss something which has been on my mind a lot, actually, for the last week or two. And it begins with the Gemara in Maseches Menachos on Daf Kaftes Amud Beis. The Gemara there discusses, states that this world has a lot in common with the letter He. Ki b'ko Hashem sor olam. With Yud and He, Hashem created worlds. Yud is Olam Haba, in the future, and He is this world. So the Gemara asked, what does the letter He have to do with Olam Hazeh? And the Gemara says, well, actually quite a lot. Because the world is really like a lot like the letter He. The letter hey is open at the bottom. It's very easy for something to fall out. It's very easy to leave. And so too with this world in the meaningful sense, it's possible for a person to take leave of meaningful living if he wants. And we may add the forces of gravity alone with the holes at the bottom. Okay, well that doesn't sound too encouraging, but it is true. So then the question is, but don't forget, as the Gemara says, don't forget, there is a gap. There is a gap between the leg of the hay and the roof of the hay. That's also important, because if he wants, he can come back. He can always come back. So then the Gemara asks a great question, like a classic Jewish question. I mean, you know, you've already got an opening at the bottom. It's much bigger in fact. So why do you need a new opening? Let him go. Let him come back the way he came out. And the Gemara says, rather cryptically, Lo istaya milsa. It wouldn't work. It wouldn't work out well. It wouldn't be successful. And that's it. So we're left wondering, in a sense, well, why not? In other words, the question sounds reasonable, let's say. It came out that way, let it go back. It's the path of, you know, it's the shortest distance between two points, a straight line. So why do you have to go around about it? Why wouldn't it work? And, of course, the Gemara can be understood on many levels. But I believe that this Gemara touches upon what we could call the paradox of tshuva. The paradox of tshuva, which I think we all realize, you know, at a certain point, is that one could almost say that the more a person needs to do tshuva, the less likely they will. And the reason why it's practically inbuilt to the process. Because why would a person feel that they want to do tshuva? Perhaps they feel bad that they're doing the wrong thing. They'd like to do better. But part of doing the wrong thing, at least after a while, is that you don't feel bad about it anymore. As if to say, presumably the impetus for tshuva is sensitivity and the will to do better. But those sensitivities themselves become dulled as a person settles into things that they shouldn't be doing. So it's almost like it's an anesthetic that coats the way back. Which means that when a person does something wrong a number of times, not only the full measure of the problem is not only has he made a mistake, but the mistake itself impedes the solution. We say at the end of our vidui, at the end of our Shanu Bagadnu, so we have that statement, Sarnu mimitzvasecha umishvatecha tovim, which means we departed. It's a statement of recognition. We departed from your good laws and mitzvahs. Velo shavalanu. And now the meaning of velo shavalanu, I think the standard translation is velo shavalanu, and it didn't work out for us. Zeloya shave. It didn't work out for us. So we're back. It didn't work out well. We recognize it. We weren't as successful as we thought we would be. That's velo shavalanu. But the Vilna Gaon, in his Perush to Sefer Mishlei, explains rather differently. Velo shavalanu is actually still part of the vidui. Because the word shaveh means worth. And really part of what happens is that the person departs from mitzvah, they will necessarily be devalued in his eyes. He can't maintain a position whereby those are very important, but I'm not doing them. The more he doesn't do them, the less he comes to see them as important. What's known as cognitive dissonance. He has to lessen the gap between where he is and where he should be. So after a while, so it's not so important anymore. And that's really part of the problem. And that's how the vidui ends. Sarnu mimitzvasechosh, where there's certain things that we stop doing, and moreover, velo shavalanu, and they stop being valuable for us. Velo shavalanu. That's the problem. So the question is, well, what's the solution? Because so far it's just a problem. And doesn't really sound like it has a solution, because the way we look for the way back, it's blocked. There's no coming back that way, because it's effectively sealed. The exit is sealed as you leave, and that's why the Gemara says once a person's left to the bottom of the letter hey, you can't come back that way, because you're not going to come back that way. If you drift out, the whole thing gets jaded and dulled, and that's not going to be the way back. The way back will necessarily be from a higher point than you left, and what that means is you will need to be acting on a higher level of consciousness, or prompted by a higher level of consciousness or awareness than the one that accompanied you on the way out. And what is the meaning of that? So, I'd like to present briefly what I think is a helpful moshel here, because it's a fascinating idea. Sometimes, the very situation that is considered acceptable on a lower level is the cause for alarm, and unacceptable on a higher level. If we take as a mashal a child, and a child has a very limited vision of what the world is about, what life is about, what his existence is about. He knows very simple metrics. He knows to avoid pain, to avoid discomfort. He knows to seek comfort, to seek pleasure. I mean, that's good. What else is there? But there's no concept of meaning or anything like that. So if his arm hurts, that's a bad situation. And if it doesn't, it's good. And what if he doesn't feel anything in his arm? Also good. Not in pain. He doesn't have the awareness of what his existence means to be alarmed by that prospect. But take a grown-up who knows what the implications potentially are. If he's lost feeling, maybe he's lost circulation. He could, heaven forbid, lose function in that limb. What's worse, feeling pain or feeling nothing? To higher consciousness, to a more mature vision who is aware of his faculties, there's nothing more alarming than feeling nothing. The very same lack of feeling which was cause for reassurance in the child is the cause of such terror. And as we know, people do whatever they can to restore circulation. They may even try and feel pain. It's better than feeling nothing. And this brings us to the difference between the way we are, or the way we can be, or what we can diminish into, descend into, during the course of the year. Even if we're not bad people, but our vision dims, our horizons, our sense of what our existence is for becomes much restricted, which means that we have many, one could say, spiritual limbs, and if we lose feeling in them, which we might do if we've kind of gone astray, but we look upon them like children. If we don't feel anything, that's okay. And then comes Rosh Hashanah. And what Rosh Hashanah is looking to do is to get us to look higher than the leg of the hay, as if to say it's looking to bring us to a higher consciousness. And how does it do that? It does so, and as soon as we hear this idea, this is in one sentence what the entire Rosh Hashanah Machzor is about. It doesn't talk about tshuva, which, as we've mentioned many times, is somewhat surprising. There's no vidui on Rosh Hashanah, and very little talk of tshuva. Instead, we talk about the world and what it should look like, and Hashem is the ruler of the world, and he's the ruler of our world, and that's it. And although it's very important, one may ask, but how is this tshuva? If I paid for my machzor and for my seat, and I want to start doing tshuva already, but I'm disappointed because my machzor doesn't let me. Because it's just talking about all these other things, and I'm not even sure how to relate to them. But this is how Rosh Hashanah opens up the days of tshuva. It opens it up by giving us a vista into the ultimate reality of the world, of Hashem's world, and then we begin to consider, where is my place in that world? And how would I function in that world? And we look at these limbs that are comfortably, lying by our side, and all of a sudden, what yesterday was quite a reassuring situation is today the cause for alarm. And when the shofar, as famous as Rambam says, it wakes us up, the alarm of the shofar should engender alarm within us. Because the most important question to ask on Rosh Hashanah is, given the world as I've come to see it, how could I function? I'm missing my arms and legs in terms of those sensitivities. And that's why Rosh Hashanah is called, more than anything else, a day of light. Ori v'yishi. Ori v'Rosh Hashanah. V'yishi v'yom ha-kippurim. And looked at in this light, I believe that we may say, the problem with tshuva becomes its solution. The problem with tshuva is that we can lose sensitivity. That is the cause of the way back. That's the impetus. Because looked at in a higher sense, which we have in Rosh Hashanah, there's nothing worse than thinking about the fact that we've lost those sensitivities. We imagine ourselves in Hashem's world. We describe the way people will be in Hashem's world, and we couldn't act that way because we don't have the capacity to do that. We've lost circulation. In that way, we feel foreign to that world. And that alone is the prime impetus for us to rehabilitate. The concept of tshuva, of course, of which much can be said, on its simplest level, is a return. And it's a return from the world that we drift into during the year to the actual world, which is laid before us on Rosh Hashanah. And the goal of Rosh Hashanah is to have a map of that world. And then try and find our place within it, and do whatever we can to restore full capacity to function effectively in that world. There's many reasons why we drift. We mentioned a quotation from Malchios and from Zichronos, but if we conclude with a quotation from Shofaros, the well-known pasuk. Everyone will come back, those that are in Ashur, those that are in Mitzrayim, representing everywhere, the world over. That's Bayomahu, in the future, when everyone will be gathered together. Rav Zevin, Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin, in the Sefer Latorah V'Lamoadim, says that every year there's already a taste of the future in the shofar. It's already a sound of the future, because people need to be brought back every year. There are two places mentioned in the Pasuk, Ashur and Mitzrayim. And of course, geographically, the Jewish people are way beyond those places. But Ashur and Mitzrayim, says Rav Zevin, are two states. The word Ashur comes from the word Osher, which is happiness. And the word Mitzrayim comes from the word Mitzar, which is distress. Says Rav Zevin, there are two people who through the course of the year, they drift, but they lose connection with the way that they should really be functioning. Some because they're lost in the world of Ashur. They're lost in their pursuit of Osher, in their vision of it, and they will do whatever it takes, as we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, and completely lose sight of what meaningful goals are. Other people lose their function because they become ruled by circumstance, difficulties, Meitzar, Mitzrayim, and Nidachim. They're pushed aside. They're pushed aside by their own lives. And they're not sure what if they can ever do anything meaningful. They can't rise above it. So Rav Zevin says every year the shofar sounds, and it's a precursor. Those that are lost in the world of Ashur, it's to alarm them. That's not what it's about. You'll never get there anyway, and that's not really what life is about. And those that are pushed aside by the straits of their lives, the shofar says you have capacity, if you activate it, to overcome all of those things, each one in their own situation, and to change their situation sometimes. And that's a very wonderful interpretation of what the message of the shofar for those that are lost in Ashur, those that are Nidachim Be'eretz Mitzrayim. It turns out that the most important letter to be conscious of on Rosh Hashanah is the letter Hey, because that really represents the way that one can lead, but it represents that portal, that entry, where we just need to rise to the occasion. When we do, we will see the way back. But is the letter Hey actually connected in any way to Rosh Hashanah? 3 hours ago, I came across the answer, which is yes. There is a sefer called Hegyonei Halacha, who quotes in the name of earlier sources. There's a well-known minhag that Psukei Dezimra on Rosh Hashanah, so different days, the chazan starts at different times. As we know, in Shabbos, Shochein Ad, Yom Tov Akel, Tatzim Ezezecha, and on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, he starts HaMelech. But he doesn't just start HaMelech. He does two things. He sings it. It's a nigun. It takes a long time. Not like the others. It takes a long time. And also, interestingly, he starts from the kahal and then moves his way forward. Why does he take such a long time over the word HaMelech? So the Sfarim say the reason why he takes such a long time is to emphasize the letter Hey at the beginning of the word HaMelech, to remind people that that is the goal of the day. He starts with the Ha, and it goes with a Nigun for a bit, because the Hey is actually the way to get back to the Melech. It's through being aware that we've drifted out, but we're looking to get higher and to bring ourselves back. And he starts with everybody else and makes his way forward after HaMelech, because that's everyone's job, wherever they are, to through the Hay to find the Melech, and then they're in their own way to make their way forward. So these are very uplifting thoughts, which Mitzvah Hashem will accompany us into Rosh Hashanah, Haba Aleinu Latova. We should all be blessed, each individual and the entire Am Yisrael, with a year of the Besoros Tovos, Yeshuas and Nechamos.